He never ate while reclining on a seat or on a wall from the moment he was sent as a messenger until the moment he died. He never ate while his back is against a chair or against a wall. He would always bend forward when he eats. Okay, that's three. And he says, وَكَانَ يَأْكُلُ أَكْلَةُ الْعَبِيدِ. He would sit and eat in the same way that servants used to sit and eat. وَيَجْلُسُ جَلْسَتَهُ. And he sits in the same way that a servant would sit. قُلْتُ, the person who was listening to Imam Sadiq said, and why is that? Why does he used to do this, the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam? He says, قَالَ تَوَاضَعًا لِلَّهِ. He's humble in front of his Lord. And also was narrated from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam that he says, كَرِهَ النَّبِيِّ أَنْ يَأْكُلَ بِشِمَالِهِ أَوْ يَشْرُبْ بِهَا. He never eats with his left hand, nor does he drink with it. Leave that thought in your mind. Let us take a short break, and then we will come back.
Ayatollah Javadi Omri, the author of the book Mafatihul Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatihul Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree. Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam, who has stressed out the reward for praying, has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program Keys of Life. So the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam, he does not use his left hand for drinking or eating. Obviously, me and you, we should also do the same. One narrator says that the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam, يَجْعَلُ يَمِينَهُ لِأَكْلِهِ وَشَرْبِهِ وَوُضُؤِهِ. His right hand is designated for three things: food, drinking, and wudu. So when it comes to these three things, he would never use his left. Also, كان النبي صلى الله عليه وآله وسلم لا يأكل حرا حتى يبرد. He would never eat anything hot until it is cold. And he used to repeat the same dua that I read to you from Imam al-Hussein عليه السلام. And also, إذا أكل سما, when he eats, he says بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. وأكل بثلاث أصابع, and he would eat with three fingers. ومما يليه, and he eats from the food that is in front of him. And then the hadith says, ولا يتناول من بين يدي غيره, and he would not take any food that is next to someone else. ويؤتي بالطعام فيشرع قبل القوم, when he sits, he is the first to eat. ثم يشرعون, so he, when he eats, he's the quickest one to eat because he want to make them feel comfortable so they could eat as well. وَيَأْكُلُ بِأَصَابِعِهِ الثَّلَاثِ, three fingers, الْإِبْهَامِ وَلَتِ هِيَ تَلِيهَا الْوُسْطَى وَرَبَّمَا أَسْتَعَانَ بِالرَّابِعَ. So he would eat with his thumb and the three fingers that are close to it. And then he says, يَأْكُلُ بِكَفِّهِ, he would use his whole hand. وَلَمْ يَأْكُلْ بِأَصْبَعِينَ, he never ate with two fingers. I mean, look at chopsticks, two fingers. Sometimes we use a spoon with two fingers. ويقول, and he says, إن الأكل بإصبعين هو أكلة الشيطان. Eating with two fingers is the way the shaitan eats. So it is something that is not recommended. Also was narrated that the Prophet صلى الله عليه وآله وسلم لا يأكل الثوم ولا البصل ولا الكرات. He does not eat onions, garlic, or the green onions. ولا العسل الذي فيه المغافير, and not the honey that has a bit of flavor, which is, has a bit of garlic into it. وهو ما يبقى من الشجر في بطون النحل فيلقيه في العسل فيبقى ريح في الفم. The مغافير, as he says, it is a sort of tree remains that stays in the bee, and the bee usually they throw that remains of trees or flowers in the asal and gives it a bit of flavor. It gives a bit of smell. The Prophet would never eat that. Now, many people said, but onions and garlic, they have a lot of benefits. Yes, they do. But each one, depending on his position, the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, because he's constantly sitting with people and talking to people, eating too much garlic or eating onions, it will make his mouth smell. And usually garlic stays in the mouth for a couple of days. So he can't hurt and harm other people with his smell. He has to make sure his mouth is always fresh. So if I and you want to eat garlic and onions and all these things, we have to make sure that we're not going to see people or sit amongst gatherings very often, because we're going to harm them. And even in salah, it is makruh, not recommended, disliked, to eat garlic and go pray. Even the malaika would be annoyed of that smell. Now, alhamdulillah, you can take garlic pills and then problem is solved if you like garlic. And also Anas says, مَا ذَمَّ رَسُولُ اللَّهِ طَعَامًا قَطْ. He never complained or spoke ill of any type of food. He says, كَانَ إِذَا أَعْجَبَهُ أَكَلَهُ وَإِذَا كَرَهُ تَرَكَهُ. If he likes the food, he eats it. If he doesn't like it, he just leaves it. He doesn't talk about it. He doesn't say, oh, I don't like this. He will never do that. We will leave it here and we will continue in other episodes. Until then, stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Driving past, walking fast to the field of dreams. Hear the children scream.
There was the Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind, a momentary emotion, space spent in time, in time.
Your option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
In Britain, anti-monarchy groups are saying the call for public allegiance to King Charles III is offensive and contemptible. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The US broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. Britons are gearing up for the upcoming coronation ceremony of King Charles III in the coming days. Amid an anti-monarchical pressure group, UK Republic is set to hold a massive demonstration at Trafalgar Square in central London. termed as a political movement that seeks to replace the United Kingdom's monarchy with an elected head of state. The protesters are said to hit the streets in yellow T-shirts and placards that would read, "Not my king," a protest slur coined by the Republic group. Ryan King, who plans to take part in the protests on the historic royal occasion, said, "The monarchy has no place in modern society given how outdated and undemocratic it is." As Britons struggle with high cost of living, Graham Smith, Republic's chief executive, sees it as a perfect opportunity to crowd the roads on the day when the king would be crowned. Graham Smith said, "People are far more critical generally of our political system, which comes into this whole debate not just about the royals, but about the condition under government and parliament." Graham Smith added, "They're far more willing to listen and engage, and they're far less interested in the royals." The invitation to the protest on republic.org.uk website read, "We want to create a sea of yellow. We will be bringing lots of placards, but you can bring your own too. Make them yellow, and we are asking everyone to wear yellow on that day." "Not my king" slogan has emerged as a signatory slogan that gained popularity, as it has been extensively used throughout the time whenever King Charles III has passed by throughout his outdoor trips. Ever since the death of Queen Elizabeth II, public support for the monarchy has nosedived to a record low. Just a few days ago, a new groundbreaking study revealed that only 3 out of 10 Britons believe that a monarchy is very important. The new survey by the National Centre for Social Research claimed that 29% of those quizzed said the monarchy was very important, 26% said it was quite important, 20% said it was not very important, and 25% said it was not at all important, or it should be abolished. Both Ryan King and Graham Smith are expecting supporters to be spread out along the route, with about 1,000 at Trafalgar Square to chant, "Not my king," as King Charles III passes by. The Journal website has also covered this story and tells us more. A British anti-monarchy group has slammed calls on Britons to swear allegiance to King Charles III during his coronation as an insult to the British people. The remark was made on Sunday, 30th of April, by Graham Smith, a spokesman for the campaign group known as The Republic, which advocates replacement of the United Kingdom's monarchy with a parliamentary republic. Graham Smith said the plans to ask the public to pledge their allegiance to King Charles III during the coronation are offensive, tone-deaf, and a gesture that holds the people in contempt. Smith added, "In a democracy, it is the head of state who should be swearing allegiance to the people, not the other way round." King Charles III's coronation ceremony is slated to take place on 6th to 8th of May. The Republic's tirade came after the office of the Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, who will lead the ceremony at Westminster Abbey, called on all the British people to swear allegiance to the new king. So far, only the British nobility were expected to kneel before the king and pledge their allegiance to him. The campaign group has announced plans to hold a massive demonstration at London's Trafalgar Square on Saturday, 6th of May, to mount pressure on the royalty and their loyalists. The protesters are said to hit the streets in yellow T-shirts and placards that would read, "Not my king," a protest slur coined by the group. Earlier in January, the group announced another plan for a peaceful demonstration at Parliament Square, which is overlooked by Westminster Abbey, where King Charles III is to be crowned. Graham Smith said at the time, "The coronation is a celebration of hereditary power and privilege, and it has no place in modern British society." He also blasted the event's astronomical price tag, saying, At a cost of tens of millions of pounds, this pointless piece of theatre is a slap in the face for millions of British people struggling with the cost of living crisis. The expensive ceremony comes as the latest figures show the UK's inflation rate stands at over 10%, the highest in the past four decades. The inflationary spiral is growing at a much faster pace than the average pay rise across the country, with food prices skyrocketing almost 20%. Increasing energy prices along with soaring energy costs have also largely contributed to Britain's cost of living crisis. Many labour unions have launched industrial action to press the government to enact salary hikes. The government, however, refuses to increase salaries, saying it would increase the rate of inflation. Experts, however, blame the existing crisis on Britain's leadership incompetence that saw the country change several prime ministers over the past 2 years. The British newspaper The Daily Mail has also covered the same story and tells us more. All Britons will be called on to swear allegiance to King Charles III at his coronation, an oath previously reserved for British nobility, in a move that has upset anti-royalists. The office of the Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, who will lead the coronation ceremony on Saturday 6th of May at Westminster Abbey, announced on Saturday 29th of April that the traditional Homage of Peers, during which representatives of the nobility kneel before the king and pledge their allegiance to him, would be scrapped. Instead, the ceremony would include a homage of the people, with the Archbishop of Canterbury calling on all people in the United Kingdom and other places where King Charles III is the head of state to swear their allegiance. The Archbishop will call on all persons in the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland and the other realms and territories to make their homage to the new king. British parliamentarians, but also Canadians, since the British sovereign is their head of state, already swear allegiance to the monarch when they take office. On Sunday, 30th of April, several elected representatives interviewed in the British media indicated that they will take the new oath during the coronation ceremony. However, plans to ask the public to pledge their allegiance to the new king during the coronation have been branded offensive, tone-deaf, and a gesture that holds the British people in contempt by an anti-monarchy group. The introduction of the new oath is one of the changes in the centuries-old ceremony, which the palace wants to evolve, particularly to reflect the country's diversity. The last coronation was 70 years ago, when King Charles III's mother, Queen Elizabeth II, was crowned. She died in September of last year, aged 96. At Saturday's ceremony, women bishops will take part for the first time, as well as representatives of non-Christian faiths. Another new feature is that texts will be read out in the languages of the other nations of the United Kingdom, that is Welsh, Scottish Gaelic, and Irish Gaelic.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
P people squeezed by inflation and demanding economic justice took to streets across Europe to mark May Day in an outpouring of worker discontent not seen since before the worldwide COVID-19 lockdowns. But what is May Day and why is it celebrated on May 1st? Also referred to as International Workers' Day, people across the world commemorate the contributions of workers and the labor movement on this day. Although observed as an ancient Northern Hemisphere spring festival initially, May 1st became associated with the labor movement in the late 19th century, after trade unions and socialist groups decided to designate it as a day in support of the working class people. The decision was taken in memory of Chicago's Haymarket Affair, which took place on May 4, 1886, when a violent clash broke out between the police and labor protesters. The incident happened after a bomb went off at Haymarket Square in Chicago, where the police had arrived to break a peaceful rally. Ultimately, 7 police officers were killed and 60 others were injured before the violence ended. It's estimated that 4 to 8 civilians died and 30 to 40 were wounded. Many of the protesters who were demonstrating against workers' rights violations, long work hours, poor working conditions, low wages, and child labor were arrested and served terms of life imprisonment, death sentences, and so forth. And those who died were hailed as Haymarket martyrs. The Haymarket Affair had a lasting effect on the workers' movement and helped push forward the demands for better working conditions across the world. This year's May Day events unleashed pent-up frustration after 3 years of COVID-19 restrictions. For months, Europe has seen a series of strikes as workers demand higher wages in the face of record-high inflation rates. In the 19-nation euro currency zone, the annual inflation rate was at an all-time high of 10.6% in October. It retreated slightly to 10.1% in November, but that was still the second highest monthly rate since the creation of the euro in 1999. Hundreds of thousands of people massed in cities around France to vent their anger against President Emmanuel Macron's pension reform. Protests took a violent turn as the day progressed, with protesters and security forces clashing. Interior Minister Gerald Darmanin told reporters that at least 108 police officers were wounded, with 291 detained across the country. Protesters threw projectiles at police and broke windows of business buildings, including banks and state agents in Paris. Security forces used tear gas and water cannons in return. Trade unions had called for more than 300 rallies and vowed to continue fighting even after the changes were signed into law. Protests had started largely peacefully, although police in Paris arrested 22 people, while in Lyon, police used tear gas to disperse crowds after bank windows were smashed. Sophie Binet, leader of the CGT union, said Macron's pension reform had left her isolated.
You just have to look at the procession behind. You can see that today is a historic May Day. There hasn't been such an important May Day in France since 1936, so we can't talk about running out of steam. We can't talk about decay. We can see that this day of mobilization is a stinging denial of all the bets made by the government and of the choice that the government was thinking of making to force us to turn the page.
Protesters mobilized against President Emmanuel Macron's recent move to raise the retirement age from 62 to 64. Organizers see pension reform as a threat to hard-fought worker rights, while Macron argues it's economically necessary as the population ages.
Canada and one of the largest industrial actions in the country's history. Some 155,000 public workers are on strike in a dispute with the government over pay. While wages are a primary sticking point, the unions also want remote work included in their collective agreement. Cleaners and cooks, clerks and maintenance workers, tradespeople, Coast Guard search and rescue teams, teachers, firefighters, and workers who process employment insurance, passport applications, and immigration documents have now walked out of their jobs.
And I can tell you that we do not have a tentative agreement. The Public Service Alliance of Canada, 155,000 members, will be on strike as of 12:01 a.m. We will remain at the table. We will remain for as long as it takes during the strike. And we will remain on strike until the government addresses our key issues.
The strike has already disrupted public services in various sectors. Lawyers say the strike has affected everyone from refugee claimants whose hearings are cancelled to sponsored relatives stuck in limbo and from migrant workers to foreign students. The workers' union have failed to reach an agreement with the federal government in an effort to bring the industrial action to an end. On Saturday, the Canadian government negotiators presented the striking public workers with what they called a final offer. The Treasury Board, which oversees public administration, said details are being kept to the negotiating table, but the proposal included an enhanced wage offer and addressed issues including telework, seniority, and contracting. In a statement, the Treasury Board called the offer fair, competitive, and reasonable. The offer, however, has so far failed to bring the strikes to a halt. The workers are escalating their strike action in a bid to block several Canadian ports to pressure the government to get their demands met, including raising wages in line with the cost of living crisis and the soaring inflation. This is while inflation in Canada rose to a peak of more than 8% last June. It is expected to remain above 3% until the fourth quarter of this year. The strikes in Canada come as the country is gripped with an unfathomable economic crisis that includes soaring food insecurity. A chief executive of one of the country's leading food banks, the Daily Bread, said hundreds of thousands of people stream in each month to get food.
We are absolutely in a food crisis in the country and certainly in the city of Toronto. Before the pandemic, we saw about 60,000 clients saying, I'm food insecure. And that number this past March is 270,000. It has escalated by four times, and in a country as wonderful as Canada is, it just shouldn't be that way.
Hetherington said of the newcomers to the 128 food banks across the Toronto area affiliated with the Daily Bread, many have full-time jobs but still can't make ends meet. Visitors to food banks in other parts of Canada also echo sense of despair and need with long queues to get something to eat at food banks. Hetherington said accommodations, both rentals and homes for sales, are out of reach for many Canadians across the country. This comes at a time when a lengthy period of higher rates could force an increasing share of highly indebted Canadians to reset their mortgages at levels that squeeze their finances. But regardless of all the economic hardships the Canadian people are going through, the government of Prime Minister Justin Trudeau spent 1.32% of its GDP on defense in the fiscal year of 2021-2022. Canadian authorities also continue with their pledge to provide Ukraine with military support in its war with Russia. After all, Canada has been one of the most vocal supporters of Ukraine and has provided billions of dollars in financial and military assistance to Kyiv since January 2022. Apart from that, Canada is the sixth largest contributor to NATO's common funded budget by allocating 13.7% of defense spending on major equipment in 2021 and 2022. Canadian authorities claim that the assistance is for Ukraine in what they call its fight for democracy. They, however, know perfectly well that they are using billions of dollars of the Canadian taxpayers' money to inject into a war which does not serve Canada at all and only favors the expansionist policy of the United States. Instead, if this money is allocated to address Canada's internal economic concerns, what else can force more than 150,000 Canadians to walk out of their jobs and call for better pays, which would subsequently disrupt all public services and make public and private sectors dysfunctional? On her first official visit to the Islamic Republic since taking office, Iraqi President Abdel Latif Rashid has visited Tehran to hold talks with Iranian high-ranking authorities. Upon arrival, the Iraqi leader met with President Ebrahim Raisi at the Saadabad complex, where he received an official welcome by the Iranian top executive official. The two sides then held a joint press conference, with boosting bilateral relations between Tehran and Baghdad being the focus of their remarks.
With regards to political, trade and economic issues, as well as the cultural domain, we have so far had good relations in those areas, and both countries are set to further expand their mutual relations.
So it's clear and is a reality that relations between Iran and Iraq are constant and solid and unchangeable.
But enhancing trade relations and economic development was not the only issue discussed between the two presidents. President Raisi and the Iraqi leader also addressed issues concerning regional security.
A security agreement was reached between the two countries, and the slightest insecurity anywhere in Iraq is regarded as insecurity for Iran. So the security of Iraq is very important for us. The security of borders is important to us, and the security arrangements between the two countries can lead not only to the security of both countries, but the security of the whole region.
For his part, the Iraqi leader praised the role of Tehran in providing assistance to the Iraqi people during the rule of former dictator Saddam Hussein, and at a time when the Arab country was gripped with foreign-backed terrorism by the Daesh terror group. The presence of foreign forces was also among issues discussed by the two presidents. President Raisi said, "As much as we consider useful the negotiations between the regional countries, we do not consider the presence of foreign forces in the region to be useful, and we regard the presence of Americans as a threat to the security of the region." Raisi said Iran's ties with Iraq and other countries of the region are based on common interests, but Americans only think of their own interests. Later on Saturday, the Iraqi president also met with the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. During the meeting, the leader called on Baghdad to get U.S. troops out of the Arab country, saying even one American soldier on the Iraqi soil is too many. Ayatollah Khamenei said the U.S. is not a friend of Iraq, adding that Washington is not even loyal to its European allies. The visit by the Iraqi leader to Tehran is of very high significance, both concerning Iraq's internal problems and regional and international issues. At a national level, the visit comes at a time when, according to Iran's president, the level of commercial and economic ties between the two countries exceed $10 billion. Not to mention that this figure can upgrade to a much higher level. According to President Raisi, relations between the two countries continue in various fields, including infrastructure, water, electricity, gas, and energy. These are the sectors that Iraq has been suffering the most from during the past couple of decades or so. That especially comes to the spotlight at a time when Iraq is trying to rebuild itself following its 23 U.S. invasion and the eradication of Daesh terrorists from the Arab country. The boosting of economic relations between Tehran and Baghdad not only will bring these two nations closer to each other, it would also help Iraq stand on its own feet after the U.S.-led war and occupation. This will also preserve the sovereignty of Iraq, given that the country has managed to be among those who have exempted themselves from the U.S. sanction measures on the Islamic Republic by continuing its trade with Tehran. After all, Iran plays a great role in developing the Iraqi infrastructure, and the presence of the Iraqi high-level delegation in Tehran can be an indication of that. In a broader perspective, Iraq has been hosting 5 rounds of negotiations between Iran and Saudi Arabia, and along with China, has facilitated the recent rapprochement between Tehran and Riyadh. That is something that would undeniably contribute to security and stability in the region. At an international level, it's not hidden to anyone that the West, namely the United States and its allies, have for decades been sowing discord and division among nations in the West Asia region to fulfill their own political and economic interests. Maybe that's exactly why these West Asian nations have come to an understanding that they should form a coalition and stand in the face of the West and its agenda, which merely aims to divide and conquer.
Iran's English language news channel, Press TV, has been targeted again. The two organizations, the Anti-Defamation League, the ADL, and the Center for Countering Digital Hate, or CCDH. Their accusation, in their words, Iranian state TV using social media to evade broadcast bans and spread anti-Semitic hate campaigns. That's according to their website. This is a new report that it compiled as proof that Iran's Press TV is guilty of spreading anti-Semitic hate campaigns. And this is the report. It begins with the accusation, which includes this icon, State Hate, how Iran's Press TV uses social media to promote anti-Jewish hatred. It elaborates on this and says that Press TV is a platform used to promote the Iranian state's hateful views of Jewish people, amongst other accusations. So is Press TV guilty of that? Well, for starters, if reporting on the deaths and violations of Palestinians is a crime, yes, it is. Press TV doesn't need to work that hard to cover Israeli atrocities. The Israeli regime does a good job of that, beating Palestinians, killing them, and evicting them from their homes, almost on a daily basis. Furthermore, the current fascist ministers openly threaten Palestinians, like Itamar Ben-Gvir, who has called for the execution of Palestinians who act against Israel, or the Israeli finance minister, Bezalel Smotrich, who has called for Palestinians to be wiped out. These are genocidal calls, but the Israeli media or organizations like the ADL do not cover this. However, looking deeper into this, it becomes clear that the driving force behind this attack on Press TV are these two men, Chris Williamson and David Miller. But who are they, and why are they being targeted? ADL's attack on Press TV became clear on why it had accused it of anti-Semitism. It had targeted Chris Williamson and David Miller because of their role in the program Palestine Declassified, as stated here. In terms of the program itself, it sheds light on Israeli atrocities against Palestinians.
Academic studies have found a long-standing pro-Israel bias within the UK's broadcast media.
They're trying to do some propaganda here to bully the BBC, which has been very, very effective.
It's because they are never properly challenged.
As if that is not alarming for the Israeli regime, the host and producer both have a rich bio when it comes to their views on Palestinians. Christopher Williamson is a British politician who was a member of Parliament for Derby North from 2010 to 2015 and again from 2017 to 2019. He's been associated with many British politicians like Jeremy Corbyn. And because of this, he has also been targeted for his role as a British MP, where he was stripped of his parliamentary pass.
Yeah, well, the first I heard about it was when I was contacted by a British newspaper called The Daily Mail. It's an absurd proposition. I mean, because people may have objections to the Iranian government.
For ADL, having a former British MP hosting a TV program for Iran's Press TV exposing Israeli atrocities is just too much to bear. Then comes David Miller, former professor at Bristol University, producer and co-host of Press TV's Palestine Declassified. He was fired from the university since he said Israel is a violent, racist, foreign regime engaged in ethnic cleansing.
Because there's a huge amount of documentation going along with the case, and that's where we will find whether the university has wrongfully dismissed me, and also whether the court will determine that I was discriminated against on grounds of my political beliefs, which is the claim that we're making.
Press TV is proud to defend the rights of Palestinians and oppressed people anywhere in the world. It has done so through its inception 17 years ago, and the station has been successful in reaching the voice of the oppressed people of Palestine to the world. Even ADL admits the incredible reach of Press TV, but although it was banned from TV and YouTube, it continues to reach up to 11.5 million followers. While Press TV enjoys this high exposure, ADL's post on Twitter had a measly 26,400 views with only 78 likes. So at the end, we ask, who is winning the social media war?
Could the turmoil in Israel prove to be terminal for the Zionist entity?
voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The pro-Israel lobby groups in the West have over the years made desperate attempts to silence and tame people, university professors, and independent global news networks over their coverage of Israeli regime crimes against Palestinians. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for the first part, please. The Electronic Intifada wrote in this regard, a Palestinian-American teacher is planning to sue a Pennsylvania university after Israeli lobby groups pressured the institution to fire him. After being fired again from another college months later, he believes he is now blacklisted from teaching. Karim Tanous taught for 2 years as a professor of business on tenure track at Cabrini University, a private college near Philadelphia. He regularly criticizes Israel and its ideology, Zionism, on his personal Twitter account. But I didn't preach this at the school. I didn't even talk about it, Tanous told the Electronic Intifada, adding that he consistently received high evaluations from his students and was known for making the material engaging and accessible. However, the Jewish Federation of Greater Philadelphia and the Jewish Community Relations Council sent letters to the Cabrini administration last year seeking to censure Tanous and have him fired over his personal tweets. Israeli lobby groups such as the Jewish Federations of North America and its local chapters have been prominent forces in the push to shut down criticism of the Zionist regime on campuses. It is also a major force behind the promotion of the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance, IHRA, highly controversial definition of anti-Semitism, which conflates criticism of the Zionist regime on the one hand, with anti-Jewish bigotry on the other. The IHRA definition has become Israeli lobby's key weapon in North America and Europe to enforce censorship about the Zionist regime's crimes against Palestinians. The Federation demanded that Tanous should face consequences for spreading what they said and claimed anti-Semitic and anti-Israel commentary and making posts in support of the destruction of Israel, according to a recent article in the Philadelphia Inquirer. Meanwhile, a Twitter account and website with a history of relentlessly harassing Palestinians and other advocates for Palestinian rights also began targeting Tanous. The blacklisting group StopAntisemitism.org named him last July as Anti-Semite of the Week.
A month before he was fired from Cabrini, the website encouraged its followers to email the university administration and submit an ethnic discrimination complaint against Tanous. During a meeting before the semester started, according to Tanous, the administration seemed to believe the Israeli lobby group's claims. But he explained that his tweets in defense of Palestinian liberation are not hate speech. It's all political speech, and you can't call political speech hate speech. Nevertheless, the college terminated him in August. Now, Tanous's lawyer, Mark Schwartz, says that they will file a lawsuit on the grounds that Cabrini discriminated against Tanous and violated his First Amendment rights. After being fired from Cabrini, Tanous then started a teaching position at nearby Gwened Mercy University in January. But he was notified within his first week on the job that he was being fired. In its termination letter to Tanous, the college's human resources department said it had received a complaint from a community member who shared an article written about you suggesting that your tweets were anti-Semitic. The administration claimed that Tanous could be biased against students due to their religious beliefs, though it made no allegation that he had discriminated against students in any way. After being dismissed by Gwened Mercy, Tanous said, it fired my lawyer up even more. Being terminated by two universities shows that I am being blacklisted for my speech, and that's against my civil rights, he said. Schwartz said their lawsuit will have precedent, and that's he is confident in Tanous' case. He cited the case of Stephen Salaita, who was fired by the University of Illinois at Urbana campaign in 2014 for social media comments criticizing the Zionist regime's assault on Gaza that year. Schwartz noted, Salaita said that he was unemployable, and this is now the case with Karim. Salaita sued the university for breach of contract, alleging administrators acted under pressure from pro-Israel donors, later settling the case. Schwartz also noted the recent reversal by Harvard University of its decision to withdraw an offer of a fellowship to Kenneth Roth, the former director of Human Rights Watch. The school's dean, Douglas Elmendorf, blocked the fellowship in December due to pressure, Roth charged, from pro-Israel donors unhappy about Human Rights Watch criticism of the apartheid regime. But amid outrage at what was widely perceived as censorship of criticism of the Zionist regime, the prestigious college reinstated its offer to Roth in January. Schwartz told the Electronic Intifada, Harvard had the good sense to reverse itself. Maybe some of the inferior universities will give pause. A university is supposed to be a marketplace of ideas. What happened to Tanous is just intolerable.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Eruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
It was his sixth hunger strike and the longest, which lasted for 87 consecutive days. Palestinian prisoner Sheikh Khadr Adnan stubbornly resisted until his last breath, asking for his release he always obtained after every hunger strike against his illegal administrative detention by the Israeli authorities. This time, however, his hunger strike ended with his martyrdom in a cold cell in the Israeli prison of Ramli at dawn on Tuesday. Here in his hometown, Arabi, near the occupied Jenin, his wife spoke to the crowd who gathered outside their home to consolidate the family and his nine children. They called for his revenge and also for all Palestinian prisoners languishing in Israeli jails.
I congratulate myself and my children for the martyrdom of Sheikh Khadr. Now, after his death and all the sacrifices he made, we do not want a drop of his blood to be spilled. We will not wait for anyone to avenge my husband. His nine children will keep his cause alive. And to the Israeli occupation, I say, remember the faces of my children well. By God, we have raised them with pride and dignity.
A general strike has been announced across the occupied West Bank in mourning for Sheikh Khadr Adnan. Protests have been held in several areas, including Ramallah. Palestinian resistance groups have mourned what they described as the execution of the senior leader of the Islamic Jihad resistance movement, Khadr Adnan. They say they hold the Israeli occupying regime fully responsible for Adnan's murder. Since 2004, Adnan had gone on six hunger strikes, drawing local and international attention. Not only did he become a spokesperson for the Islamic Jihad, but also a symbol for the cause of Palestinian prisoners.
The Israeli regime has sent a clear message to the whole world that we will continue killing Palestinians even after their imprisonment. Today, Sheikh Khadr Adnan has set a new level full of pride in the history of Palestinian prisoner movement. After his assassination, the Palestinian people are facing a new stage of struggle. Today, we all must unite and stand against the practices of the Israeli regime for the sake of our prisoners.
All Palestine is sad for the martyrdom of the hero prisoner Sheikh Khadr Adnan. It was not his first hunger strike. Every time he was courageously declaring a hunger strike to reject the illegal administrative detention that the occupation's regime uses to keep thousands of our people behind bars. Unfortunately, this time his strike came to an end with his martyrdom.
Meanwhile, several protests have been held in the occupied Ramallah in response to the Israeli murder of Sheikh Khadr Adnan. The demonstrations turned violent in a number of areas, namely the cities of Arram, Al-Khalil, and Ramallah, with clashes erupting between Israeli soldiers and Palestinian protesters. Israeli forces fired at the crowds and a number of Palestinians were wounded. The day of rage will always be remembered as a day of honor and loyalty to Sheikh Khadr Adnan, who is considered by many here as a national hero. Every time Sheikh Khadr Adnan engaged in a hunger strike, he insisted that he will not end his action without achieving victory. His definition of victory was either getting released or being martyred. This time he achieved victory by martyrdom. Palestinians also believe he was an iconic figure who succeeded in bringing another defeat to the Israeli regime. Mona Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
Against the backdrop of that all-familiar soundtrack and amid heavy police presence, pro-Palestinian protesters outside the Leicester branch of the notorious Israeli arms maker Elbit Systems. A short walk into the woods from the demo, members of the Palestine Action Group, donning the iconic Palestinian keffiyeh with one purpose in mind.
I'd like to see Elbit out of the UK. I'd like to see Elbit shut down once and for all in the whole world. But obviously, you know, where we are and what we can do is get Elbit out of the UK. And ultimately, that's what I'd like to see. I'd like to see Elbit Systems completely gone from UK soil.
Beyond the steel fence and barbed wire, Elbit's UAV Tactical Systems manufactures drones on UK soil. Drones allegedly tested on the captive population of Gaza.
And I was there in Gaza for 2 years. I saw what those weapons do, and they are knowingly making them, selling them. In fact, they are even marketing them based on how much horror they have committed across Palestine and still ongoing.
is unable.
Members of Palestine Action and other Palestinian supporters have come here today saying they're having to take direct action against Elbit Systems because lobbying the British government through normal channels is futile. And they're calling on people around the world to join their campaign to put an end to Israel's international arms trade.
Elbit, Israel's largest weapons maker, used to host 10 sites across Britain. 18 months of protests and blockades by Palestine Action forced its site in Oldham, Greater Manchester, shut last year.
And it's time. It's time that Israel finally got brought to justice. We've seen enough horror, murder, oppression, occupation, ethnic cleansing. Enough. We've had enough.
The last time Palestine Action tried to close Elbit's Leicester site was 2 years ago. This time, they say, they won't leave until they have finished the job. Saeed Pariza, London.
It has become a well-trodden political path. Press TV being attacked in the British Parliament. This time the mouthpiece was the vice chair of the Conservatives' Friends of Israel.
A shocking report into the online activities of Press TV, particularly their use of a video series called Palestine Declassified, which focuses its hatred on British Jews. Whilst Press TV may be banned from our airways, this foreign state hate operation is continuing online. Can we have a debate at some point on what more we can do to ensure that social media platforms tackle this outrageous content?
In the decade and a half since it was established, Press TV has found itself front and center of Western media attacks. But despite the pressure, the channel continues to advocate for the voiceless, chief amongst them, the Palestinians. The show at the heart of the latest onslaught is Palestine Declassified. Its host, former Labour MP Chris Williamson, gave his take on why the show was such a bone of contention for the pro-Israel lobby.
What we've seen here is a shameless attempt by the Israel lobby in the House of Parliament to whitewash Israel's criminality and lawlessness. And of course, they're very concerned about the fact that Palestine Declassified is shining a light into the murky corners of Israel's activities, and indeed on the lobby that seeks to avoid any criticism of their suppression of the Palestinian people. It's Palestine Declassified is, you know, very effective. It scrupulously researches all of the content that we put out, and obviously, you know, they're embarrassed by the truth that we are bringing to a wider public. And of course, you know, the traction that Palestine Declassified is now picking up, it's been suggested, reaching well over 11 million people now. So they're doing their damnedest now, it seems to me, to try and close down our success.
Chris has written a stern letter rebuking some of the smears parroted by Andrew Percy.
There's no truth whatsoever to the allegations that you made. I mean, it suggested that, you know, we sort of are a vehicle for hatred towards British Jews. I mean, the programme is doesn't sort of promote hate in any respect, or it suggested anyway that he should consider apologising for maligning me and for impugning the reputation of Palestine Declassified and Press TV.
As Palestinians continue to live under an oppressive regime, Press TV's fight to advocate for justice will see it targeted as part of Israel's campaign to close down anyone who stands up for the Palestinian cause, a move branded media terrorism. Amina Taylor, London.
The members of the Pakistani parliament are insisting the coalition government to eliminate obstacles in starting the oil trade with neighboring Iran to overcome the country's energy deficiency. MPs' voices were heard during the recent meetings of the parliamentary committees, in which lawmakers stressed upon the government officials to robust diplomacy for aggressively pursuing options to secure waivers on the oil trade with Iran.
We get 1 million liters of diesel from Iran every day. It's called so-called smuggling, and it's, I think, 50 rupees per liter as compared to here. We should open this up. The region has to open up.
The lawmakers recommended that all-out efforts should be made to secure waivers from sanctions on oil trade with Iran.
I've been saying to the government also that we should open up these borders. Because, like, for the first time, Iran-Afghanistan trade is more than Pakistan-Afghanistan trade. And I think if they can have it, and it's benefiting both countries. So this trade would be very good for us also.
According to the data provided by Pakistan's Commerce Ministry to the Parliament, Pakistan's trade